He has sent us to proclaim recovery of sight to the blind, to set free the oppressed, and announce that the time has come and that the Lord will save his people. The Lord will save his people. Sometimes we read all kinds of things going on in the world. We go through all sorts of problems in our life. We look at the pictures we just saw. We live from Monday to Friday. But that scripture still remains true. The Lord will save his people. Jesus is here. He's here as much as he's ever been. He's here to bless, to lift up, to strengthen. And he has chosen us to go out and to be his arms, to be his mind, to be his heart, to love those around us. I can't actually remember what I spoke to you guys about the last time I was here. And I thought I'd shared my testimony, but when Jane spoke, I'll give you the extremely edited version. I'm the youngest of 12 kids. I was brought up in Ireland in a Catholic family. And I was brought up very much to believe that God is quite a distant figure, that he's definitely there, but he's kind of up there somewhere. And his job is every so often to sort of stick his finger out through the clouds and tell you off or put you in the right place. And I'm not here to diss Catholics or not Catholics or anything like that. I believe there's many Christians in the Catholic Church. It just so happened that I was brought up in the Catholic Church. As I started growing up, life became quite difficult because I was the youngest of 12. And everyone that went on before me had done their thing in life. They had had jobs, some of them very successful jobs. I had one brother who became the youngest consultant ever in Ireland. He's now a cardiologist. And there was a lot of pressure growing up underneath siblings like that. And I felt that pressure at a very young age. So I can remember them having talks about me, whether I would actually go be a doctor or go and be a lawyer. And I thought, man, this is too much. So at about the age of 11 or 12, I can remember just stealing some cigarettes from home and already developing the habit of puffing on cigarettes to try and get rid of the pressure. At about the age of 15, I was politely asked to leave the school I was going to. And then I went to London for a few months at the age of 15. And it always amazes me, actually, now, is to meet 15-year-olds and to think, how did I survive in London on my own at the age of 15? Eventually, I went back to Ireland and kind of made everything up with my brothers and sisters and sort of lived the life back in Ireland. I remember one occasion being very, very, very drunk in a bar in Ireland and talking to my brothers and sisters. And I said, guys, there's something missing from our life. I don't know what it is, but there is something missing. Because we have you have your jobs, families, education, but there just doesn't seem to be a peace in us. And I said, it's like this, and these are pretty much the exact words I use. I said, it's like we want a red sports car. We do everything we can in order to get that sports car. We channel our lives to make it happen. After 6 months, we get it, and then we want a red sports car with special wheels. I goes, none of you can look me in the eye and tell me that you are truly happy. And they couldn't. It was like one of those weird moments where we're just all quiet and everybody was kind of thinking, saying, maybe our crazy youngest is actually saying something sensible for once. So I said to them, I piped up and said, you know what? I'm going to go and find it. Whatever it is that's missing, I'm going to find it. So I remember at the time, there was one thing I should add into that. My sister, she was a born-again Christian. And I knew there was something pretty special about her. But I couldn't work out, was she just a really nice person or was it sort of God in her? And she used to constantly send me Bible verses. And she had an amazing ability to just love and accept me for exactly who I was at the time. She would take me for walks and walks, and we'd walk for hours. And I would just spill everything out and talk about everything that I was going through. And now when I look back, I know that it was Jesus walking with me through her, that he would just listen and listen and listen and listen and just accept. So I thought, well, she might have it, whatever it is we're looking for. And she had a friend that she had brought over from Kenya who was in Bible college with her. And he had that same kind of weird peace. And I thought, actually, I'm going to go find this guy. He was living in Kenya. And I thought, I'm going to get to Africa. I'm going to see if he's got this answer. So I prayed. I said, God, if you're up there, you've got to show me. And it was a very simple prayer. I had about 75, in fact, I had exactly £75 in my pocket. I got a lift in a lorry. Got as far as London and basically arrived in East Ham because the lorry driver just, he chucked me off in some roundabout that I don't even know where, but somewhere outside the outskirts of London. Made my way through to East Ham and met Penny's stepbrothers in Plashet Park. And as soon as I met them, I just knew they had it. They had what I call it is eternity in their eyes. They had that same thing that my sister had and her friend from Kenya had. I thought, they've got it. And it was just such excitement rose up in me that I thought, they've got the answer to it all. They were normal people, like you well know, they had their own problems and issues, but they just had that thing. So from there, I just went for it. Because for me, I was very young, the way I used to approach life was, if God exists, if he really does exist, then therefore that means that he should mean everything. And that life should be all about him. Or else he's pretty much not worth knowing, or else he can't really be God. So I just decided to follow him with everything I had. And this was when I became 18 years of age. Then I met Penny. And it was funny, at the time, because I'd lived quite a different life, I didn't want to have anything to do with ladies whatsoever. And not that Penny isn't very beautiful, and I just thought, I want to move completely away from the sort of life that I was living. And Penny and I became the best of friends. In fact, we never really went out together. We went out once and we broke up the next day. And we just prayed together. And then Penny went off to Africa for a year, came back, and then we just decided, let's just get married. It just seemed to be the most logical thing to do. So from there, we then thought it was time to leave the East End. We felt Lord just leading us. And we went through a few different missionary agencies and we got the offer to go to Bulgaria, which is in Eastern Europe. At the time, I'd felt that I just really wanted to help people. I had this passion that when Jesus came, this is what he did. He, more than anything else, he was a really nice, kind, loving guy who helped. He was there for people. And I thought the church has got to be like that. As Christians, we've got to be like that. We have to make people know that they are loved and just genuinely, naturally loved. So we started visiting the homes in Bulgaria, and I was struck by these kids. I just thought, this is too surreal, this is too weird. I can't believe this exists. And you saw some of the kids at the very start with the legs wrapped up around their back and up. And I thought, this is amazing. And I thought, I want to do something about this. So from there we started off a foundation. Well, actually, somebody gave us a gift. We had a person who visited us and they said, like, I want to give £500 towards that particular home. So I asked the church, would they receive the money? And they said they couldn't because of legal issues. And I thought, we had problems actually getting the money into the country. And from there we decided, somebody told us, you need to set up a foundation. So we set up the foundation. We had to give it a name, but it started off very simply like that. And we went on from step by step. At the start, we were involved with the church, and every Christmas and Easter, they would bring bags of goodies to the kids. And I thought, this is good, but it's not enough. I want to be involved in changing their lives and actually really being light and bringing light into those dark places and changing their lives. So it was quite difficult at the start because I was supposed to go to Bulgaria as a church planter. So on the one hand, I was trying to plant churches, and at the other hand, I was sort of doing this whole charity thing. My boss came to visit me after a few years, and he goes, Mark, look, the charity thing is great, but can you please give it up? Because you're here to actually plant churches. So I said, okay, I'll try. And I said, I'll give you 2 years. So he came back after about a year, and the charity had grown in about four times the size. And I said, honestly, Phil, I have tried. I've tried to give this thing away, but it just keeps coming back and comes back bigger. So he said, I could either be really angry with you or else wake up to the fact that this is what God is really using you to do. So he said, we'll just go with it. So then began to work. And when that happened, it was like, right, now I really, really am going to go for this. And initially he spoke to me when I first went into Bulgaria. He said, Mark, he gave me examples of other missionaries in Europe and how that certain missionaries got on the like the country Baptist board and were involved in directing the church for the country, and sort of set me a goal to head. And I thought, well, I haven't done that. But we thought, let's change the country and the way it relates to disabled people and the way it actually handles them and how it cares for them. Because when I saw the homes, I thought, we don't have this in the UK. We don't have this in Ireland. We used to 30, 40 years ago, but we just don't treat kids like this. That if they have a disability, we just shove them off to some small village and they get looked after in ridiculous ways. Now, at that time as well, we saw loads of money coming in. Like one building that was built in one of these homes by British Airways, and this isn't a knock at British Airways, but I thought, this is ridiculous. They're making bad systems worse by pumping money into orphanages. So we decided then that we were going to work with the country and we were going to strengthen Bulgaria's ability to actually develop the way it cares for disabled people. So we went to a home that was called Gordon Kosnitsa. Actually, I completely lost track of time.
Keep going, I'll stop you.
Okay. So we went to this home called Gordon Kosnitsa. And I've never, ever seen anything in my life. It was the most frightening, horrific. You'd go in there. When we first went in there, it was just screams and crying and wailing. And part of me wanted to just slightly step backwards and pretend I never saw it and just get out of there. But then part of me also thought, God wants this place changed. He does not want this place to exist. This is not His will. So I remember saying to a lady who was with me, a New Zealand lady, saying, we're going to close this place. And she said, she goes, okay, I'm with you, but have you got any idea how we would do it? I said, I have no idea whatsoever, but I know that this place shouldn't exist. So let's go for it. Now, obviously, to tell you the story properly, I'd need hours to tell you about how we made the connections we did and how we did, so I'm going to have to give you a very edited version. So we set about the job of closing down the home, which basically, when you close a home like that, you can't just shut the doors, because where do the kids go? And in fact, just to give you a very brief description of the home, it was for 58 residents, both children and adults, and they had basically both physically and mentally extremely disabled. To give you again the idea of the place, the sort of place when you went in there, the smell was just completely overwhelming. They had three classrooms where they separated up 58 people. So you had something like, if you divide 3 into 58, you'll get an idea of how many people were in each classroom. There were small classrooms, probably about the size of from here down to the corner and up. And you imagine one lady, I've got three kids. Sometimes I feel like throwing them through the window with anger and trying to get them to do what I want to do or just cope with them. So these poor ladies had to deal with about 20 kids of all diverse disabilities, both physical, mental, with violent tendencies. You walked in there and the first thing you wanted to do is you were just like this, wanting to puke. I thought, how did he even stay in this place? It really was hell. I'll tell you one very, very quick story of to give you a real idea. As the first time we went around the home, we went into this small room, which was about the size of where the drummer is, maybe along like this and over from the pole. And the smell was even worse in this place. And around the walls, from about here downwards, the plaster had been ripped off the walls and it was back to bare brick. It was like a jagged edge. I thought, what went on in this place? And what used to happen was, because they didn't have enough money for both heating and for both staff, that in the earlier years, all the residents, between the time of 5 o'clock and 8 o'clock, were basically herded into that room, 58 of them, just for the 3 hours. Just shoved in there. And they'd literally clawed the plaster off the walls. And now, thanks to God, this place is a bedroom for some of the older males, and we have 3 beds in there. But that'll give you an idea of the sort of place. So we had to set about our work of closing it down. So how do you close down an orphanage? You basically have to set up proper services in the community so you can integrate these people into the community. So you're talking about things like adoption, fostering, and what we call family-type homes. So the idea is you build houses, and you don't have 50, 60, 70 people sleeping together. You don't have people using communal baths and communal showers where they just go through it like sheep having a dip. The idea is that you have 2 kids to a bedroom. They have their own pajamas. They have their own little locker where their own clothes go into it. They have their own personal possessions, which they never had before. Little pictures on the walls. Little teddy bears. Anything that's appropriate for a child that age. So that's what we've built. But there's a big story as to how, and in fact, right now as I stand here, after about a year and a half working in this place, we've managed to develop, to work with the government, central government, in allowing this to happen. We've worked with local government and worked with the home itself to bring everybody together to actually make this happen, to develop things like daycare centres, resource teachers for schools, to build these homes, train staff, retrain old staff, do talks in the community, so that what we have now are what we call family-type homes in the community, where the community can start taking care of the disabled kids, rather than just they're being shoved out in the middle of nowhere. And it's basically going to happen about in the next month or so. And, I mean, it's been an absolute roller coaster ride, miracle after miracle. I remember when we had managed to convince central government that, guys, you need to do this, you need to help us in doing this. The Ministry of Labour, the Ministry of Health. And that involved going into meetings where honestly I had no idea what I was going to say, but just really begging and asking the Lord, please guide me and tell me what it is I should be saying when I go in here. We finally got them all on board, agreeing that, okay, Mark, we'll go with this. And then I had the horrible, crushing thought. It was like, honestly, somebody catching a few of those heavy speakers and just putting them on the back of my head. It hit me, I thought, where are we going to get the money to do all this? And I just thought, what have I got myself into? Where are we going to get the money to actually make this happen? And that was actually a very, very lonely time out in Bulgaria, because I just felt like, what have I done? And about a week after, about 10 days after that, we got a phone call from central government saying that they were going to release 8 million lever to actually close 8 homes in Bulgaria, and that they were going to give us, in partnership with the municipality, 3 million lever to actually close the home down properly. And you will never have seen or met a happier Irishman than to actually get that news and to realize it. But it showed me that God was with us, that he really, really was with us. I want to just finish very quickly with, sometimes people often ask me, and they say to me, Mark, but where's Jesus in all this? And my response to that, to them, is, tell me first where Jesus isn't in all this. And it honestly has been the most humbling, honoring few years to bring the gospel to kids that can't actually speak or that can't actually express themselves. And maybe sometime in the next few months, whatever, if you're looking and thinking about interesting things to talk about, think about that. How do you bring the gospel to people that can't actually have all sorts of issues from being institutionalized for their life, but how they can't actually communicate verbally? I mean, I know the answer because I learned it working with these kids and being with them. And it was a very, very just humbling thing just to be involved in caring and doing what Jesus would have done for these guys, which is just going into the home with them and helping them and being a light to them in there. I have no idea what time I was supposed to start or finish, but I'm going to ask Penny to come forward and sing for us. I won't